The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, exploring the human endeavor.
Soundworks.
Soundworks.
From PRI.
Hi, it's Patrick Cox here, and I used to do a thing in the podcast called Eating Sideways. It highlighted a word or a phrase in another language, a word or a phrase that there isn't an English equivalent for. Eating sideways, being a case in point, is from the Japanese yokomeshi, and it means literally eating sideways, eating horizontally. But the Japanese use it to describe the feeling of speaking a foreign language. It's like you're eating on your side. It's a lovely expression. It makes you think in a different way about speaking a foreign language, about eating, for that matter. It makes you think in a sort of enhanced way, like all good metaphors do. And there are thousands of these expressions, often unique to their languages or their language families, and only translatable by explanation rather than the quick way, word for word. One more slightly different example, the French word chouette. Literally, it means a type of owl, but much more frequently, people use chouette to describe something that's cute or friendly or even really terrific. I mean, it sounds ridiculous when you think of it literally, like, that's really type of owl. But use of the word chouette, it depends on the moment, and that means that the French are likely to know what is chouette before you do. So is that untranslatable? Is yokomeshi untranslatable? Better ask Michael Wood. He's an English professor at Princeton, and he's one of the editors of the Dictionary of Untranslatables. Michael Wood and the Big Show's Marco Werman talk here about what untranslatable really means. Here's Marco.
I gather you have a quiz for me. That's how we're going to start this interview. So go on, ask me a few questions, Michael.
Okay, Marco. Well, the first part of the quiz is to ask you to define an English word. One of the things you learn about when you think about translating, especially about untranslatable, is that we often don't know quite what we mean by our own words in our own language. So would you say what you think, let's say, the word soul means?
Soul, S-O-U-L?
Yeah.
Soul is one's kind of... Ooh, boy, that's a tough one. Soul is one kind of spirit being, if you will, one's mind, the kind of consolidation of thought and belief.
Very nice. If you had to distinguish between soul and spirit, how would you do it?
Ooh, that's a tough one. Spirit, I will say, I'm going to go for a German word here, is one's Zeitgeist. It's kind of like what motivates
okay.
one. And soul is
okay.
more kind of a kind of soul is more of thank you, producer Nina Porzuki. Soul is more of an essence, kind of like the life force. Oh boy.
And that's good. That's a great definitions. And I think they illustrate, you know, how much play there is in these words, you know, that once you start thinking about them, all kinds of stuff comes to mind. Let me ask you about the word truth, for example. If I think of truth, for example, I just think it means true is just not false. It doesn't have any magic for me. It's just if the things correspond to what they're supposed to be, they're true. But that's not usually how the word's understood. In Greek and Latin, it means what's no longer veiled. In German, it means what lasts.
I tend to go the same place you go, which is truth is kind of the opposite of what is false. So everything that we know that is not false has to be true.
Yeah, that's what I think, yeah. But there is this history. The word's got this longer-term sense of something a little final and better and bigger than that. We might be using it in this rather clean, neat, modern way, but actually other people aren't.
So your dictionary is called the Dictionary of Untranslatables. It's actually a translation from French. So clearly you got through translating 400 literary, philosophical, and political terms somehow.
Yeah.
What do you actually mean, though, by the term untranslatable?
Well, it's a very contested term and a kind of interesting one. It's got several meanings, but in one simple sense, it's important to be clear about nothing is untranslatable. Mm. You can always translate it somehow. You know, you can patch it up, you can fix it, you can get there somehow. I mean, translation is not an art of perfection. It's not copying. It's rendering in one language, something that began in another language, and you can always do it. You can always get there in some way. But there is a sense that, with many words that when you've translated them, you just feel you haven't done the job, even when you've done the best job you could.
And why is that?
It's not because there's something essential, I think, in the other language that you can't translate, but there's something interesting that you're really missing. if you know the other language, you feel you haven't got it into the new language. It's that residue, that sense of something missing. It's not quite what gets lost in translation because it wasn't found in the first place, but it's some difference that you treasure. So it's really about differences. Barbara Cassin, the editor of the French volume, she defines the untranslatable as that which one can't stop translating.
Well, I think of the Portuguese word saudade, which is used a lot in Brazilian music. And you say to a Brazilian, what does that mean? And they say, oh, it's untranslatable. But then they will go on to describe it as a sense of longing for the past, slightly mournful, but also slightly warm sense of the past, almost a nationalistic sadness. And then I say to the Brazilians, see, you just translated it. So
exactly, yeah.
give me a word in English that you find is the example you kind of roll out as an untranslatable English word.
Well, there are lots of them, but I think the word fair, for example, fair and fairness is pretty much untranslatable. There's no equivalent in German, French, or Spanish, or any language that I know. There's a very good entry in the dictionary on the word fair by a French philosopher. She knows the meaning of the word, but at a certain point, she sort of seems to think of being fair is just getting things right and doing things by the book. Hmm. Whereas my idea is that sometimes, to be fair, you'd have to not do things by the book.
Interesting. So it's not just simple justice or a sense of being just.
It's not equality justice. It seems to me there's something more, a little more mysterious and more intuitive and more to do with local occasions.
This book, since it had been written in French, it was then translated into a number of other languages, Russian and Arabic and Farsi. Mm-hmm. Why apparently did English pose such a challenge in translating this book of untranslatables?
Partly because it's a global language. A lot of people speak English. It's the one foreign language they speak. So it has a lot of sort of traction and a lot of interest and so on. And also partly because the French book was sort of written in a way against English, right? That is, it was meant to defend the multiplicity of European languages as against the invasion of global English taking over the whole world. So there was a kind of interesting paradox in putting the thing into English, when in fact English was what it didn't want to be. so that was kind of difficult. But then there were lots of words like, for example, entrepreneur, which George Bush once said the French don't know the meaning of. Turns out he was right, as it happens. Entrepreneur, really? In modern sense, is an English word. Entrepreneur in French used to mean inventor or undertaker, someone who did things. That was what an entrepreneur was and still is in French. We've borrowed it and made it purely commercial. So it's sort of interesting.
One place the notion of untranslatables seems to take us is kind of almost stereotyping different cultures and people who speak those languages. So, the possible danger of seeing that there is a French way of being happy or a German way, doesn't that lead to stereotypes and generalizations?
That is the big danger, I think, of this kind of book. The attraction of difference, of seeing that everything is different and cultures are different and people are different, that's all good things. Everything local and specific is all good. But the danger, I think, is the one you identify, that at some point the specificity will be some kind of essence, some natural essence, stereotypes, and every French person will be impeccably French, every English person will be impeccably English and so on. I think that's not good. And so that has to be resisted, but it's very tricky.
Yeah. What is your favorite untranslatable term from the dictionary?
The Spanish word desengaño, disenchantment is what it means. There's similar uses for the French word illusion, for example. In English, English speakers are such pragmatic folks that you think if you're to be disillusioned is to be deprived of your illusions, and a good thing too, because now you know the truth. In every Romance language, the notion of being undeceived also means disappointment, as if you didn't really want to be undeceived.
Hmm.
You would think that a title like Balzac's Lost Illusions would mean, okay, good, now we woke up, we wised up, we know what the truth is. But actually, that title is full of regret. It's as if we wanted to keep our illusions.
Michael, I'm just curious, how do you envision a reader practically using this dictionary of untranslatables? The risk is that they start reading this book and they go down a rabbit hole because it's so interesting.
I think the way to read the book is just by little bits. You find a word you're interested in and you track out the word and then you stop and do something else more sensible and go back to the book later. It's like a maze, like a labyrinth. You would follow the signs and one day maybe you'd come out, but maybe you wouldn't. You would just be lost in there forever.
Well, mission accomplished. I certainly got lost in it this weekend.
Okay.
English professor at Princeton, Michael Wood. He's also one of the editors of the recently translated Dictionary of Untranslatables. Michael, thank you a lot.
Thanks very much, Michael. It was a real pleasure.
And from untranslatable stuff to stuff that's all in English, the Man Booker Prize. You may have heard of it. It's Britain's biggest literary award. And this year's different because for the first time, American writers are eligible. Before, they weren't. I guess they didn't write in English or something. Now, as I speak, the winner hasn't been announced. It's still a few hours away. By the time you listen to the podcast, though, I imagine that there will be a winner. But let me play you in the meantime this from the 6 shortlisted writers. They're talking about their influences, the writers and the books they most admire. But I'm more interested in the magnificent variety of accents on display here.
Hello, my name is Joshua Ferris, and I'm the author of To Rise Again at a Decent Hour. The first thing that comes to mind is Ralph Waldo Emerson, not exactly a book writer, but he was an essayist and diarist from the 19th century. Emerson is important to me both as a man and a writer. Emerson said, "In every work of genius, we recognize our own rejected thoughts. They come back to us with a certain alienated majesty." I think this was, among the other things that he said, an important thing to hear from me because it asked me to trust myself, my instincts. And when you're a young writer making mistakes, it's not easy to do that. So I took great lessons from Emerson.
Hello, I'm Howard Jacobson, author of Jay. Very hard for a writer ever to know what influences on a particular book are. The books that have been most important to me are novels by Dickens and novels by D.H. Lawrence. Dickens I think about all the time because he had that wonderful gift of being funny while being extremely serious. And he was able to be both in a single paragraph, in a single sentence. And D.H. Lawrence, well, Women in Love was the great novel of the disaster of the First World War, but he never mentions it, and that intrigues me. And there's always that sense in Lawrence of people picking up the pieces.
I'm Ali Smith, and my book is called How to Be Both. Partly I have a feeling and a sense that every single thing I've ever read will have had some influence on me. I'm including things like the words on pencils and on the sides of buses. But if I think of the books that I'd like to say had influenced me, it's like a list that kind of stretches out to the crack of doom, which begins with Lewis Grassett Gibbon, and he goes on from there to Muriel Spark and George Mackay Brown and Catherine Mansfield and Virginia Woolf and Clarice Lispector and I could carry on just saying names. I suppose the thing that I find most exciting is a work which will ask questions of us as we read it. Something which at the same time engages you sensorially and intellectually and to the heart. That'll do it for me.
I'm Neil Mukherjee and I am the author of The Lives of Others. I can't talk about influences, but I can talk about writers who have been important to me for my reading and for my thinking about the novel form and the themes of the novel. A German writer called Heinrich Böll, V.S. Naipaul, is a great influence on my life, and the Australian novelist Patrick White. I think of these three writers as having made a deep impression on me.
I am Karen Joy Fowler, writer of We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves. The book I usually cite when I'm asked what books have influenced me is T.H. White's The Once and Future King. I read it when I was probably 14 years old, but I've reread it often, and the influence it has had on me, I think, is to make me believe that books can be very expansive, that the tone can change a great deal, that the genre can change within a page or certainly within a chapter, and I like that capaciousness. I like to think that a book can do many, many, many things.
It's Richard Flanagan, author of The Narrow Road to the Deep North. William Faulkner, when he was asked what were his three favourite books, replied, Anna Karenina, Anna Karenina, Anna Karenina. I only have to say it once, Anna Karenina, because for me it's the most beautiful story of love and about love that I've ever read.
The Booker Prize nominees, accents as diverse as their writing styles. Well, that's it. Go to pri.org/language for all blog posts on this and all the other pod episodes. That includes all the other episodes that'll make up the translation series we're running right now. It's called In Other Words. And for other podcasts in the Soundworks Network, one with Farai, Sideshow, and Radio Ambulante Unscripted, go to soundworks.org. See you on Facebook at the World in Words page, or on Twitter, I tweet as Patricox, PatriCox. I'll be back soon.
The World in Words is made possible in part by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, Exploring the Human Endeavor. The World in Words is also supported in part by PRI's New Voices Fund, bringing new perspectives and personalities to public media. Donors to the fund include Maureen and Michael Rutgers and the Sarah and Evan Williams Foundation.
Soundworks.
Soundworks
from PRI.